From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday. Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government with an update. There's a resumption of senior shopping buses, and he'll talk about the upcoming 9/11 services in the county. Eddie Adams, he photographed 13 wars, 7 U.S. presidents, 65 heads of state, and countless celebrities. We'll chat with Cindy Adams, his sister-in-law, about the Eddie Adams documentary screening tonight at the Narrowsburg Union and the new exhibit of his work at the Union Digital Gallery. Plus, Catskill Talks. We talk to another acclaimed photographer, Jeffrey Hutchinson. He'll be here tomorrow at our Liberty Studios for a special live in-person appearance. We'll get a preview. And we'll check in with the Hudson Valley Area Labor Federation. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. World leaders are arriving in New Delhi for the G20 summit. The presidency of the bloc is rotational, and it lies with India this year. But political observers say India's government has turned this into a marketing campaign for itself ahead of upcoming elections. Sushmita Pathak has more.
These days, posters and billboards about the G20 are nearly ubiquitous in Indian towns and cities. Many of them feature Prime Minister Narendra Modi's smiling face. The G20 presidency is symbolic, not an achievement. But political analysts say India's leadership has used it to advertise the country's growing clout, with Modi as the person responsible for it. His party is looking to be re-elected next year. Observers say the level of hype around the G20 in India this year is unprecedented. Indian officials say the mega public relations campaign was done to take the G20 to the masses. Modi has called India's presidency a people's presidency. For NPR News, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
Hurricane Lee is now a Category 5 storm with top sustained winds of 165 miles per hour. It is hundreds of miles east of the Leeward Islands. NPR's Dave Mistich says at present the storm is not a threat to land, but some places on the East Coast could see dangerous rip currents.
Hurricane Lee is barreling toward the Caribbean. The National Hurricane Center says Lee is expected to pass well to the north of the northern Leeward Islands, the Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. But life-threatening rip currents are likely to affect the Caribbean as the weekend progresses. Forecasters say it's too early to say what effect Lee might have on the Atlantic coast of the United States and Canada. Still yet, National Hurricane Center forecasters say there will at least be dangerous surf and rip currents beginning Sunday. Dave Mistich, NPR News.
Stocks opened higher this morning as Japan reported slower economic growth. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 30 points in early trading.
Asian shares were lower overnight after Japan downsized its estimate of second quarter economic growth. Revised figures show Japan's GDP grew at an annual rate of 4.8% this spring, not 6% as had been reported. The Federal Reserve has a full board of governors once again. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed economist Adriana Kugler to fill the last open seat on the board. Kugler will be the first Latina to serve on the Fed's governing body since the central bank was founded more than a century ago. Fed policymakers are expected to hold interest rates steady when they meet in less than 2 weeks. The Fed's already raised rates 11 times in the last year and a half in an effort to curb inflation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is now up about 40 points at 34,541. The Nasdaq is up about 60 points. This is NPR. General Motors has made its first counteroffer to the United Auto Workers Union. It doesn't match the UAW's demands. The union is warning it will strike GM along with Stellantis and Ford if it doesn't reach contract agreements with the automakers by the deadline next Thursday. Fighting has resumed in Lebanon's largest Palestinian refugee camp. NPR's Ruth Sherlock says heavy gunfire and shelling have reportedly wounded at least 6 people and caused residents to flee.
The clashes are between fighters from the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement and Islamist groups. In July, Fatah accused the Islamists of murdering one of their military generals, and thousands of residents from Lebanon's Ain al-Helouay refugee camp and from the nearby city of Saida fled from the fighting that followed. At least 13 people were killed. A tentative truce was then put in place, but Fatah insists it wants the Islamist factions to hand over the individual who killed their general and had threatened raids on the schools the Islamist fighters have occupied in the camp. This has sparked further clashes. The UN refugee agency, UNRWA, has appealed for funding to repair the damage caused in the camp by the fighting. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
Russia is holding local elections that will last through the weekend. It's also holding local elections in occupied parts of Ukraine, an effort condemned by Western leaders. A year ago, Russia unilaterally declared the Ukrainian regions its own territory. Ukrainian officials are urging other nations not to recognize the Russian voting results. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Focus Features with My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. The Portakalos family is headed to Greece. From director Nia Vardalos and featuring the original cast. Only in theaters September 8th.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Dan Hoost is the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday for an update on what's going on in Monticello. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for being here. The legislature had a meeting yesterday, and some news coming out of there about Garnet Health. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on there?
Legislators met with the leaders of Garnet Health yesterday. Jonathan Schiller, who is the CEO of the overall Garnet Health, was recently in charge of the Harris Hospital. Then he moved on up to that position. And also Jerry Dunleavy, who took his place at the Harris Hospital. And it was a meeting just to for Garnet to reaffirm their commitment to Sullivan County. There has been talk, of course, going around about, is it more Orange-focused than Sullivan? What's the future of the Harris Hospital, the Calicoon Hospital? And the conversation, which I'm told was very wide-ranging, it was an executive session, so I wasn't privy to it, but I have been told that legislators came away feeling very confident about Garnet's commitment to the community. I think people know, too, that they've been determining what their future is with the now almost 50-year-old facility in Harris, but we're not going to lose a hospital in Sullivan County. Whether it's there, whether it's someplace else, whether it's something that has to, well, it's going to have to adapt to the future of healthcare, which has changed in the past 50 years. But we're still going to have a hospital, an emergency department, everything that we need in Sullivan County for that immediate care, emergency, urgent. And also the Calicoon Hospital, I hear, is doing wonderfully these days, which is nice because that's the one I live closest to. And that even though Garnet Health is based out of the upper management is based out of the Middletown Orange campus, that they have not lost sight of Sullivan and they plan to improve services here as they are able.
I just want to pick up on something you said. We're talking about reaffirming their commitment to Sullivan County.
Yep.
We mentioned the age of the Harris facility. You said something will always have a hospital. Did they indicate that they might be breaking ground elsewhere or anything like that?
No, they're not at a point of breaking ground or anything, but I know that they have to be looking at this point as to are they going to stay in that facility or are they going to go elsewhere? I mean, we talk about strategic plans, you know, that we all have to have as organizations. Mm-hmm. And they have to have one, too. And I think last year there had been a rumor that they were closing the Harris Hospital. And they've been in close touch with us since then. And this was a meeting, I think it's almost a year since that rumor started. They wanted to come back and say, listen, we are as committed as we were last year when we told you we are not closing a hospital, any hospital, Harris or Calicoon, in Sullivan County. Down the road, of course, I would fully expect that there's going to have to be new facilities created. Where, when exactly, I don't know, but they wanted us to say there's not going to be any gap in services, any closure. And of course, you know, they had some layoffs a few months ago. I think there were five that affected Sullivan County directly, but they were all in management. And they wanted to reaffirm also to the legislature that these were strategic layoffs, not some impending doom that was coming up on the facility. Listen, hospitals everywhere, especially the nonprofit variety, I'm sure are always trying to make ends meet. It's an expensive thing for all of us, including those who run our healthcare facilities. But they said in the strongest terms possible, and that's what the legislature wanted me to convey here, they are not leaving Sullivan County.
And then in July, Jonathan Schiller, CEO of Garnet Health, was quoted about the facility in Harris as saying that Garnet's began discussions about the right size, shape, and location for the Harris campus, with options that may include building a new building or refurbishing the existing one, and that it's going to take another year or two of study for concrete alternatives to emerge.
That's and even if they pick something after that, it's probably going to be another 5 years to create something. So the places we know that have the Garnet name on them are going to have it for a while to come, and even if those finally are sold or disappear or whatever, Garnet is still going to be our primary hospital level provider in Sullivan County. And the legislature was very pleased to hear that, because we cannot afford to just ship everyone down to Orange County. We need to have a facility or facilities like we do in Harrison Calicoon here in Sullivan County.
Yeah, and Jonathan Schiller, CEO, was also quoted in that River Reporter article in July saying that Grover Herman Hospital, the Calicoon campus in the western end of the county, has the system's full support, and was quoted as saying, "I don't think that hospital will ever go away. There's so much community support for it, and there's so much need for it. It's really the right size, the right location, and it's the right mix of services, and it works." End quote. That's Jonathan.
And that's
Schiller.
What they reiterated that to legislators yesterday.
And that might be sort of a model, maybe, for what they're looking at.
I would say so.
Other alternatives,
whatever works there that they can create elsewhere. Of course, it serves a smaller population, so they have to keep in mind the larger, especially the summer influx is more pronounced on the eastern side of the county than on the western, although that's been changing, as I can speak to being from the western side of the county. We have had a lot more people this summer in particular, right up through the Labor Day weekend.
We should note that Garnet Health is a financial supporter of WJFF. Also at the legislature yesterday, a remembrance of Corporal Kyle Muthing. Story there, but
yeah, Corporal Muthing passed away unexpectedly earlier this week. I believe he's going to have a full military honors funeral tomorrow because he was a veteran, and it was, like I said, unexpected. He was 45 years old, a very well regarded member of our sheriff's office. They took a moment of silence during the Public Safety Committee meeting yesterday, and it was just it was touching and heartbreaking to watch. This is somebody that all of us knew, all of us cared about, and to have him leave us at this point in his life so quickly, it was hard for everybody and devastating to his family. And the county as a whole gives its condolences to the Muthig family, both his immediate family and his extended family in the sheriff's office, because this has been very hard for all of them.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dan Hoost, communications director from Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update. Also updating the resumption of senior shopping buses. Those were paused for a minute.
Well, the full service was. We had two running in the towns of Highland and Delaware that were serving sort of those particular areas. They were open to the public, but because of the pandemic and the short staffing, it has taken this long to get it back up to speed. But I'm happy to say, and we'll have a press conference later today where we're going to talk about this, in front of where the Bethel Senior Center, which the Bethel is where we'll start doing the service again on Monday, we will have 5-day-a-week service rather than 2-day-a-week service throughout Sullivan County. Now, each day is going to be a different area of the county because we don't have 15 drivers for all 15 townships in Sullivan County. It will also be on a reservation, first-come, first-served basis. But these buses can hold, I think, about 10 to 15 people, if not more. And it gets our senior citizens to their medical appointments, to their shopping appointments, to basically the business and nonprofit needs that they have. Well, we aren't going to be taking them to a friend's house, or I don't think we do even like library trips. This is a very specific kind of a service, but it is door-to-door. And that, especially in a county as far-flung as Sullivan, 1,000 square miles, to know that if you're living out in Long Eddy, for example, somebody can come pick you up and take you to Liberty or Monticello to get shopping or doctor's appointments done, or even just down the road, maybe to Calicoon or to Jeffersonville. We can do that. And it's something I'm excited to hear more about as we have our press conference today. But in the meantime, if folks are interested in finding out more that they don't want to wait for the press conference and the press release to come out, they can give a call to 845-807-0244. To make a reservation.
One more time.
845-807-0244. And we ask that reservations be made at least 3 business days in advance.
All right. And speaking of buses, school's back. Back in session. Got behind a school bus today.
Oh, did you?
On the way in. Good to see everybody. Getting back. Should have timed it better.
Yeah.
But you want to remind folks about school bus safety.
Yeah. Our Bureau of Fire actually put out a great graphic on their social media page about school bus safety. And it reminded me that it's not just for us who are driving around the school buses, but the kids who are on these buses, too. It really is the safest situation when all of us are paying attention. Now, frankly, I think the onus is on those of us who are driving around the school bus to make sure that we are not passing it when its red lights are flashing and it is stopped. Even when we're on, for example, a 3 or 4 lane part of 17B, which I travel a lot, I see that over in the Montgomery Valley, Monticello area, that folks don't realize or are ignoring to everyone's peril. The fact that a school bus is over on the rightmost lane and they're way over on the leftmost lane, no, you've still got to stop because you don't know if that kid's going to have to cross the road or dart into the road. In fact, some school districts, I don't think any of them locally, but some are starting to do cameras on those flashing stop signs that they deploy when they stop to catch people who are just ignoring the law and putting children's lives in danger. But of course, too, for kids, and I hope parents and school districts have talks with kids about school bus safety, how to safely get on and off the school bus and not to be running around. And I've watched kids who follow the school bus driver when they have to walk in front of the bus and cross the road. The bus driver will tell them when it's safe to cross the road, which is good to see because I frankly do get nervous when I'm around stopped school buses on a busy street. It's just a potential for disaster there. So we all need to keep that in mind.
I will say that I was happy to see that the school bus driver had stopped to make sure and wait till the child was safely in his or her seat. There were about 5 or 6 cars behind that bus this morning. And as that child got safely in his or her seat, the bus driver pulled up a little bit and then pulled over to let us all pass, which was like a nice gesture.
You.
So school bus driver on Route 128 at 8:30 this morning. Thank you.
Yes, that's I really do appreciate that when they do that. But that's not always possible.
No.
And we need to be sure that we are not tailgating and not honking our horn and certainly not passing a stopped school bus.
Everybody was following the rules and being considerate this morning, at least in my experience.
There. Good.
We'll take a quick break and we'll come back with more with Dan, who's communications director from Sullivan County Government. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Cassie of Rare Pair Radio. It's a weekly showcase of primarily female artists, but also a wide range of avant-garde musicians, the fruit of post-punk, experimental, and fringe music.
Your eyes are set on stars. I love to see you shine, because you really blow my mind.
Rare Pair Radio, Friday at 8 p.m.
Your heart beats like a drum.
Radio Catskills Community Awards Ceremony is Thursday, September 28th. We're celebrating local arts and culture, honoring CAS, DVAA, NACL, Chandelier Music Festival, Wayne County Arts Alliance, and Weekend of Chamber Music, along with special recognitions for Harold Tye, the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop, and Franklin Trapp of the Forestburg Playhouse. Tickets at WJFFradio.org for Radio Catskills Community Awards. Thursday, September 28th, 5 to 7, Seminary Hill Orchard and Cidery in Calicoon.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're speaking with Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. He's the communications director and joins us every Friday with an update on what's going on. You have a new emergency services training center coordinator. Let's talk about that person. And then let's also remind folks what that center does.
You don't want to say that title three times fast?
New Emergency Service.
No, don't.
ESTCC?
Yeah. Let's just call him Joe Moll.
Let's call him Joe.
That's his name. He's Joe Moll. Grew up in the Jeffersonville area. The Moll family is a longtime name in Jeffersonville. I know plenty of them. I talked to him the other day about it. And he says, yeah, that's a cousin, that's a cousin, that's a cousin. So Joe is a great guy. He like I said, grew up in Jeffersonville, graduated from what was Jeff Youngsville School, now is Sullivan West, just about a year after doing that, at the age of 19, joined the Jeffersonville Fire Department, where he has served as everything from a firefighter just out there pulling hose and fighting those fires to president of the company. He's currently assistant chief. I believe he's going to be chief of the fire department shortly. He's been doing it for over 25 years. He also is a skilled, all sorts of things, laborer. He's worked on excavation projects. His father, now I think his brother, runs a excavation and I think sewer and other kind of digging up projects. I'm not being very eloquent about it right now, but he just has a lot of experience, local experience. He's a community guy, local family guy, and he is now our Emergency Services Training Center coordinator. He takes that over from another Jeff name that people probably know, John Hauschild, who is still our fire coordinator, but has now been promoted to our deputy commissioner of public safety under our commissioner, Scott Schulte. So congratulations to all of them, actually, because Scott's new to us. John has got this well-deserved promotion, and Joe has just joined us as of the end of August. And the Emergency Services Training Center, sort of this hidden asset that we have, and it's not that hidden. It's off Old White Lake Turnpike near Swan Lake, not far from the county airport. I actually spent 3 months of my life there almost every day when the COVID pandemic hit, because it doubles as our emergency operations facility. But in times of non-COVID, in times of peace, it's serving as a training facility for our emergency services workers, our firefighters, our ambulance corps volunteers, and other folks too who need to get training. We offer EMT and CPR courses there to general public, and we have, I think, BOCE students doing an EMT course there right now. So Joe's got a lot to work on. He will be overseeing that entire facility. He doesn't have any staff under him, so he'll be working with other folks to make sure everything gets done. And, you know, we have DPW workers over there who keep the facility looking very good. But Joe, as he told me, is not above having to sweep the floor or clean the bathroom if he needs to. He's that kind of a guy. He will roll up his sleeves and get to work because he loves being part of a team. And so we welcome him for that. And I'll have more to share in a picture of him that I'm putting out shortly, so that folks can see who this guy is and feel, I think, very confident that the training of our emergency responders, that the facility is in good hands for that. He does some training, I think, himself, but we bring in a lot of people to train there too, and he just makes sure it's all coordinated. We have over 50 fire departments alone in Sullivan County, so this facility gets a lot of use.
Monday, of course, is September 11th. County is honoring those folks in the memory of those who lost their lives, heroes, neighbors, responders. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the events that are planned for Monday?
Sure. The fire service actually lost, I think, the bulk of the people, the emergency responders who perished at 9/11. So, of course, it's fitting that it's mostly fire departments that are holding 9/11 observances on Monday, including Smallwood Mungup Valley, which has a piece of the World Trade Center at its firehouse. I've seen it there. It's a very well-done solemn ceremony. That'll be happening at 8 in the morning on 9/11, around the time, I believe, that the first plane hit the first tower. The Wurtsboro Fire Department is partnering with the American Legion Mammocating Post 1266 to do a procession that lines up at 6:45 p.m. at the Wurtsboro Firehouse. That's the new firehouse on Pine Street in Wurtsboro. The old firehouse is over on Sullivan Street. People may be familiar with that. I think the procession will go along there, but just in case folks are looking to be where the lineup is. It's a newer firehouse. Be aware of that. Mm-hmm. The Monticello Fire Department will have probably the largest ceremony that I know of in the county at 7 p.m. At the Monticello Firehouse on Richardson Avenue in Monticello. And that includes a very solemn ringing of bells that they have, a bell actually, that they have out in front of the firehouse. It's a kind of a ceremony that can move you to tears, but I highly recommend folks to go to it because it has that emotion that's necessary in such solemn ceremonies. And then finally, the town of Highland is doing one at 6 p.m. on 9/11 at the appropriately named Heroes Park, which is right there in Eldred. There may be some others. These are the ones that we're aware of in Sullivan County. But, of course, we ask everybody to at least take a little bit of time on that day to remember what was lost and what resulted from that day.
And in Wayne County, the county will hold a ceremony on Monday at 8:30 at the 9/11 Memorial in front of the Dimmick Building at 901 Court Street in Honesdale. Elsewhere in the Catskills, the Hudson Valley, there's a list of memorials and events that honor those who were lost on 9/11 at hvmag.com. And before we go, one more mention of the food scrap program. Yes. We've been talking about this for the last few weeks, and I will tell you, I'm looking at my food scraps in an entirely different light.
Okay. Well, we've got, I think we're getting close to 100 people signed up, but we want 400 or more to sign up for this. So that's why I'm going to continue being an annoying voice in people's ears this. But sign up for this. If you're doing it at home, great, wonderful, fine. Then you don't need to sign up for this. But if you aren't, many people are not. We want you to sign up for this so that we can demonstrate to the state that there is a need and a desire for a composting facility in Monticello, because that's our future strategy with that, to really make that a part and parcel of everybody's life in Sullivan County. And the first 400 to sign up for this pilot program, which starts October 1st, but we're doing registration right now, they'll get a starter kit, which will include containers and instructions on how to use those containers to get the food scraps to us, which we will take off your hands at no cost. You just need to get it to us, free of any packaging or anything. This needs to be the food scraps themselves. But we'll take it as often as our transfer stations are open. You don't have to have this sitting around smelling up your house. And we will document every bit that we get, because the tonnage that we ship over to the Ulster County Resource Recovery Agency will count towards the case we'll make to the state that we can do this in our own backyard, because we've got people willing to be a part of, I think, something very important. It keeps the food scraps out of being buried in the ground, where all they do is create useless methane. Mm-hmm. And it also keeps them from cluttering up your garbage and maybe attracting critters that you don't want. If your garbage is smelly, it probably has organic food scraps in it that we can take off your hands at no cost.
Let's remind folks how they can sign up and be a part of this pilot program.
Sure. Recycling coordinator Cassie Thelman is her name. She is great. I think the best part of this for many folks will be a chance to meet and talk to her. She is available in person at our Monticello transfer station. You're welcome to stop by and say hi to her and talk to her there. She'd love it. You can email her at cassie.thelman@sullivanny.us, or the easiest way is to call her at 845-807-0291. That's 845-807-0291. She'd love to hear from you, and I'm not lying.
Dan Hoost, Communications Director from Sullivan County Government, joins us every Friday. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Eddie Adams, there's a documentary and an exhibit at the Narrowsburg Union. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and restaurant on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, featuring local American fare, specialty cocktails, craft beers, and Sunday brunch. Menu and hours online at TavernOnMainNY.com.
And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, this is Thane Peterson, host of the Living Jazz Show. I wanted to let everybody know that this Saturday, my guest on the show is going to be Sarah Elizabeth Charles, a talented young singer who jazz critics describe as a rising star. So join me this Saturday from noon to two for Living Jazz with Sarah Elizabeth Charles. With the listen, with the listen.
Move Sullivan, Sullivan County's free bus system, helps people get around. Whether they're going to work on time Monday through Friday, visiting doctors in Monticello, Liberty, Rock Hill, and Harris, or heading to class at SUNY Sullivan. Move Sullivan helps people shop in downtown Wurzburgo or Conejunga Lake, or takes them to the Coach USA bus station so they can go even farther. Info at movesullivan.com or 845-434-4102. Move Sullivan, connecting our communities. Paid for by Sullivan County Government.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In his more than five decades as a photographer, Eddie Adams received more than 500 awards in honoring his work, including the 1968 Pulitzer Prize and World Press Photo of the Year for his iconic image, Saigon Execution. His photographs influenced public opinion and changed policy. His legacy lives on in the Eddie Adams Workshop, a tuition-free seminar for young photographers he founded in 1988 right down the road in Jeffersonville. A documentary, An Unlikely Weapon, The Eddie Adams Story, will have a special screening in the Delaware Hall of Narrowsburg Union tonight at 5:30. Plus, there's a new exhibit of his work at the Narrowsburg Union. Here to tell us more about it is Cindy Adams, his sister-in-law, and we're also joined by Valerie Mancy, our arts reporter. Hi,
good
guys.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Cindy. You know, Eddie Adams, a lot of people in our area, like in the Jeffersonville area, Sullivan County area, know about him and who he was. Can you explain to him, folks who may not know as much about him, a little bit about his work?
Well, Eddie was very prolific, and as we know, he photographed many wars, but he also photographed celebrities, heads of state. I think one of Eddie's gifts was that he treated everybody the same, and he had a way about him that made everybody feel comfortable, you know.
Yeah, and then as I mentioned, he established the workshop, a seminar for young photographers in 1988, which lives on to this day. We were contacted by them recently to have another photographer come in to follow us around. Can you talk about a little bit about the legacy of him there and why it's so important?
Yes. Well, once upon a time, Alyssa said, wow, you know, wouldn't it be, my sister Alyssa said, wouldn't it be great if there was a workshop where the students didn't pay anything? And Eddie thought, lit on to that idea and just thought that was the best thing. And he called all of his friends, which were vast.
Big friends.
Yeah, Gordon Parks, Joe Rosenthal, you know, the Kirklands. I mean, Douglas Kirkland. Just called people that he knew, Harry Benson, and got a group together. And I remember the very first workshop, the yellow school bus brings the students up the driveway. And they hadn't had, the electricity wasn't quite on yet. So about 20 minutes before the students came up on the bus, they got the electricity on and everybody clapped and the students came up. And it's, what is this, the 35th year, I think, this year?
Yeah. It starts October 6th, goes through the 9th.
Yeah. And it's
Jeffersonville Columbus Day weekend.
Correct. And, you know, the 35 years, it's been a wonderful journey. And I have to say that I think there are, when we did a little short film, not that long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, 13 students have gone on to win Pulitzer Prizes.
Wow.
Maybe more by now because I haven't done the research, but that's a nice legacy for Eddie.
Let's talk about the documentary.
Yes. Tell us about the documentary. When was it done and what is the focus?
Well, the focus is pretty much Eddie and his career, his personality. I started the film in the early 2000s, and it took a good 7 to 8 years to actually complete the film, which when you're financing your own project, that's pretty much the way it is. And my neighbor, when I used to live in L.A., I lived in a courtyard apartment. It was very communal, and Eddie would come and visit, and we always picked up Nick Oot. We went out for Vietnamese food immediately, or Mexican. And one of my, Eddie was a character. He'd come in with his hat, walk through the courtyard. And one of my neighbors at the time was a filmmaker, Adam Rifkin. And he said, God, you know, Eddie's interesting. You should do a documentary on him. And I was like, really? You know, he's like you know, I saw him all the time. And I said, you know what? That's not a bad idea. So we started to interview him, shoot him. As we got more serious, you know, I started to follow him. I went to India and Thailand with him and started to actually hire crews, you know, sound and a cameraman and things like that. So it got a little more in depth. And then, you know, there was a lull. And then I met up with a woman who actually had a editing room and a little, you know, some. We finished the project finally. And we were shortlisted for Academy nomination. And we did like no press. We just kind of rushed into, we did some film festivals and things like that. But, you know, it's kind of a love letter to my family, to Eddie and things like that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and it was screened at the Calicoon Theater.
Yeah, and now there's a screening tonight at 5:30 at the Narrowsburg Union as you launch into this exhibit that's going to be at the Narrowsburg Union. Before we talk about the exhibit, I want to talk a little bit more about the documentary and the title, An Unlikely Weapon, the Eddie Adams story. What's an unlikely weapon mean in terms of the impact that Eddie had? Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, the camera is an unlikely weapon. And Eddie felt like the camera was his choice of, you know, Eddie was a Marine when he was young. And so he learned photography at a very young age. I think in his local paper, he won a contest. I think it was $500 at the time, which was a lot. And then he never stopped taking pictures after that. And I know that Eddie would go out into the field with three cameras. He would have a short lens. I'm not a photographer, so a long lens and then a backup.
Yeah.
And he always had three cameras around his neck. And so an unlikely weapon is
that what he yielded, is the camera. But right. Also, I think it goes further into how the impact he had on policy and government. His series on the Vietnamese boat people, Boat of No Smiles, helped persuade the U.S. to admit 200,000 refugees at the end of the war.
That is probably the one of the things he is most proud of. In 1977, he called the series the Boat of No Smiles because wherever he was in taking pictures anywhere in the world, when he would hold a camera up, children would smile. It's just a natural instinct. But on this particular boat that he had gotten on, he said it was the kids did not smile. So he called it the Boat of No Smiles. And these, yes, the photos helped persuade Carter to, we gave asylum to the refugees, which was Eddie was very proud of that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Cindy Adams, sister-in-law of Eddie Adams.
It's Cindy Jinx.
Cindy Jinx. Now, I forgot you're married. Congratulations. And also behind the documentary, An Unlikely Weapon, The Eddie Adams Story, which will have a special screening in the Delaware Hall of the Narrowsburg Union tonight at 5:30. Eddie Adams photographed 13 wars, 7 U.S. presidents, 65 heads of states, and countless celebrities. There's an exhibit that's going to go along with the screening at the Union, which will appear there free to the public. Can you talk about some of the photos that are going to be in the exhibit at the Union?
Yes, there's quite a few. There's a variety, but one of them I think is the Fidel Castro portrait. And I know that Eddie went to Cuba with a writer for Parade magazine. And they went to Cuba and they waited to see Fidel, who just never appeared. And I think they were there a few days. And Eddie got angry and angrier and angrier. And he said, look, I'm not hanging out for this guy. I'm leaving. The writer was horrified. So they came back. And then Fidel called and said, look, I'm available. Can they come back? You know. And so they went back, and then the first thing he said to Eddie was, oh, I hear you have quite a temper. And so anyway, they did a nighttime session, which was all night long. Eddie had a private session. and, you know, got some great shots of Fidel smoking his cigar. And then they were, Fidel said, okay, you know, we got the shot now. Goodbye. And then Eddie said, no. I need to see you doing something that you do. You know, I want to see you doing something. So the next day they blindfolded Eddie and they went duck hunting to Fidel Castro's favorite duck hunting place and all, got some more shots. So that picture will be in the show.
And I should also clarify that the opening reception for the exhibit, Eddie Adams Workshop and Legacy, is at 5. And then the screening is a special screening tonight at 5:30 until 7:30. But the exhibit goes on at the Narrowsburg Union in the new innovative gallery space, the Union Digital Gallery, which has got a lot of new tech to showcase all of these photos. Anything else you want folks to know about Eddie Adams and your memories of him before we go?
Well, Eddie was a character. He was a lot of fun. He was larger than life. He, when he walked into a room, you know, people would notice. He, you know, Eddie was, he didn't do anything lightly. And everything he did was full tilt. And he was a lot of fun to be around. But he also, he had so many ideas. And he never looked back on what he did. He was never comfortable with, he was always looking forward, which I think is incredible. He was always looking to the next picture, to the next, you know, thing that he wanted to concentrate on, whether he wanted to design clothing, you know, and things like that. He was always, you know, branching out. But do I have a minute to talk about the picture?
Oh, sure.
Okay. So when Eddie felt that the assassination shot was misunderstood, and the reason that
This is Saigon execution.
The Saigon execution taken in 1968. Eddie went to Vietnam in 1965, and he was there for a while. He came back, and he was in New York City walking around, and he was just disgusted by the way the vets were treated. And he said, you know what? I didn't do what I needed to do. I'm going to go back. So he went back, and then in 1968, was at the right place at the right time, took the picture. But what you don't hear about the picture is that the Viet Cong that had been caught had just killed a South Vietnamese Air Force major and his whole family with a total of 6 people. And this particular family was friends of Luan, General Luan. And nobody ever really mentions that.
Mm-hmm.
So Eddie felt that the photo was misunderstood. And
how did he feel it was misunderstood?
Well, because this the Viet Cong that they captured had just killed General Luan's friend and his whole family. And so later, Horst Voss, who later went to Vietnam and interviewed this the Viet Cong's wife, the one that was killed in the picture, she confirmed that he was a member of the National Liberation Front. So, you know, they were kind of looking for him. They had been looking for him. And what is interesting is the execution-style killing was very common in Vietnam. It's just that people didn't take pictures of it. You didn't see a lot of it.
Right.
And the South Vietnamese soldiers were also known to torture and kill you know, prisoners.
Which made it so impactful, this photo, that you had not seen this practice going on.
Correct. So the photo is a moment of truth, you know. And for me, and for a lot of people, it characterizes the whole conflict.
The whole war.
And that's why I think people, it was in your face, and there it was, and that's what, but Eddie always said that photo ruined 2 lives that day.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, later down the road, he went to Virginia, in Springfield, Virginia, Luan had opened up a pizza shop, and he almost, they weren't going to let him into the country because the Immigration Service said, well, you know, that was a war crime. But Carter said, no, he can stay in the United States. And so Eddie went to the pizza place, and he went into the bathroom, and etched in the stall was, "We know who you are," with a
expletive.
Yes. And So, you know, he said to Eddie, hey, you know, like, I couldn't really do anything, so I had to learn how to make pizza. And he was like, you know, and Eddie always felt bad that he had ruined, you know, two lives that day, not just one. Eddie was never really proud of that picture. You know, he never felt good about that.
Well, despite not feeling good or not feeling proud or feeling it's misunderstood,
yep.
Do you feel that Eddie, let's say outside of this photo, like this one photo that's so iconic, do you feel that he went into the field with intent? Did he go into the field to expose the truth, to show you these images you didn't want to see?
Absolutely.
That was part of his mission.
Absolutely. And you know, Eddie was a Marine. He was very patriotic, but yes, he did. He went in to show the truth. And it's hard to actually get a photograph like that. You have to be at the right place at the right time. Everything has to line up.
And if the truth of a photo like that makes the viewer uncomfortable, well, then that is the point.
I think it helped to de-romanticize. It really helped to stop the war in, you know,
really bring that moment
yes.
to crystallize in people's minds, because when you're looking at, you know, things so far away, you don't really identify with it.
Right.
But in terms of like just his, you know, the I go back to the title of the documentary, The Unlikely Weapon. Do you feel that we've talked about how it was this weapon that was the unlikely weapon. Did he see it as the unlikely weapon? Was he, again, going out like, I'm going to break this mold a little bit?
Yes, a lot of photographers actually carried guns. Eddie did not.
Yeah.
He did not. And so the camera was his weapon of choice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Val, anything else you want to ask before we go?
I just was curious about the effects that it had on him working in what are sometimes horrific situations. There had to be an emotional price somewhere.
I think so. He had a lot of men that he, there was a group of people over there that he stayed in touch with. But Eddie, you know, he didn't carry all that baggage around. Like, he was so busy when he got back. He wasn't somebody he wasn't traumatized like some people had issues when they got back. And Eddie seemed to, if he did, he really worked through them. He was busy, so he was, you know.
Buried himself in his work a little
bit. Yeah, I think so.
He went on to span advertising, corporate, entertainment, fashion, feature photography, worked with Time, Vogue, Vanity Fair, and Parade. And this is an interesting stat. He shot more than 350 covers of Parade in 25 years. The Eddie Adams Workshop and Legacy is an exhibit premiering at the Union Digital Gallery tonight at 5 at the Narrowsburg Union. And there's the special documentary screening of An Unlikely Weapon, The Eddie Adams Story, at 5:30. That is tonight at the Narrowsburg Union. And it is a free screening. Thank you so much, Cindy Jiggs, who is joining us today. And there's more information about the exhibit, the screening, at narrowsburgunion.com. And as we mentioned, the Eddie Adams Workshop in Jeffersonville is October 6th through 9th. There's more information about that, eddieadamsworkshop.org. Cindy, thank you so much. Val, thank you.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, a preview of Catskill Talks. It's an event happening here tomorrow. This is Radio Catskill.
The Catskill Talks.
Hello, I'm Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. Tune in to our headline news service for stories about Indigenous communities across the country and around the world. Hear about top concerns facing Native nations. Tribal history, language, and culture is also part of Indigenous life. Check out our headline news service to learn more. Tune in here for National Native News.
Weekdays during All Things Considered.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman was not too impressed with the idea of official New York City rat tours.
As a New Yorker, I feel like rat, oh, that's the tourist thing. You want a real New York experience, go see the roaches. That's
I'm Peter Sago. When you listen to this week's news quiz, don't turn on the lights. We might all scurry away. Join us for the news quiz that observes all kinds of creatures in their natural habitat. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Acclaimed photographer Jeffrey Hutchinson will be here for a special live in-person appearance tomorrow at Radio Catskills Community Room at 5. It's part of Catskill Talks. It is a continuing artist series this summer. It's made possible in part with funds provided by the Sullivan County Arts and Heritage Grant, funded by the Sullivan County Legislature, and administered by the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. Patricia Rubio has a preview of the Catskill Talks with acclaimed photographer Jeffrey Hutchinson. He spoke with Jason Dole.
The Catskill Talk series is a series of talks that we created to sort of really delve into what makes an artist tick and why do they create the work they want to create. I mean, I created this talk series about 5 years ago originally from the Works for Art Alliance. And it was really for selfish reasons as I moved up here from the city. And when I was living in the city, I've always attended artist talks and gallery talks. And I just love hearing the process of the artist. And when I moved up here 8 years ago, I didn't find a lot of it around, more in my area, down in sort of the Fallsburg area. So that's the reason why I created it. So, you know, been going out here 5 years strong, a little hiatus with the pandemic, but now I'm glad that we're back in Liberty and back at WJSF Radio Catskill. So coming up in September, we have the second to last talk, because in October will be the last talk. And so I guess we just talk about September's talk, which will be Jeffrey Hutchinson, who is a photographer. He just had a show at Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. He's a black and white photographer. He does landscapes. He does these beautiful, beautiful, striking landscapes of like beaches and rock formations at these beaches and secluded places. And it's really interesting to see how he does his printing and how he goes about it, because not only is he a photographer, he's also a businessman. He created or opened up one of the few publicly used dark rooms in New York City. And I've used his dark room when I left college. I studied photography in college, and when I left, I learned during the time of film and needed a darkroom when I left college, and lo and behold, there was a darkroom in the city that you could rent time in and rent space in, and it was just like I had in college. And lo and behold, I just found out recently, I didn't know that Jeffrey Hutchinson started that darkroom, and he still runs it to this day, and it's one of the premier darkrooms in New York City for photographers who shoot a film and want to process their own prints and film. So he's a very interesting person, not only on the photography side, because he's a photographer, but also on the business side and how he really expanded the art and how he helped a lot of photographers in the city during the 90s and 2000s, especially during the transition between film and digital technology.
And that's really cool, because then not only are you creating a talk where, you know, just a general person in the public who has, you know, any kind of interest in the arts and the role that they play in our community can learn more about what the artist is doing and why. But those people who are engaged in their own creative endeavors, whether it's in that artist field, a related field or an unrelated field, can get something out of it too, hearing about all these various sides, whether it's the practical side, or the business side or the professional side. Like there's different things that different audiences can get out of the same talk.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the good things that we're doing the talks now at Radio Catskills is that it's being recorded. And it will be airing on Sunday stage, sometime in the near future. Of course, we want all the folks to come live, to witness it live, because it's, you know, nothing beats live, because not only will you meet the artist, but the artist will be giving a presentation, especially Jeffrey Hutchinson, who is the photographer. He will be giving a presentation, before, sort of a Q&A starts. And he'll be showcasing his work there, maybe having some prints available, at the studio, and, you know, really hear his journey before we delve into sort of like the background and where he started from. And, you know, because everyone has a different story of how they got into photography and what led up to where he is now. So,
okay. And it's happening Saturday. Do you want to give people the details on the time? We mentioned the location is right here at our studios. They just come on over, right?
Yep. It starts at 5 o'clock at the studios in Liberty, our Liberty studio. That's 2758 State Route 52. That's at 5 o'clock. All you have to do is come by, have a seat, open your mind and enjoy some artwork, find out some behind the scenes, We're going to have some refreshments, some cookies, some drinks. So it's always good for people to come and attend. But yeah, we'll be here this Saturday, and the talk starts at 5 o'clock. So it'll be a great time to be held. Like I said, he's a fantastic artist, and these series really sort of help bring out exactly say why these artists do what they do.
Right. It's Patricio Rubio, organizer of the Catskill Talk Series, our own Patricio Rubio here at Radio Catskill. I want to thank you for the series so far, and good luck on Saturday's presentation.
Thank you so much. Hope to see everyone there.
And again, the Catskill Talks project is made possible in part with funds provided by a Sullivan County Arts and Heritage Grant, funded by the Sullivan County Legislature and administered by Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. There's more information at our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, check out our locally produced shows and our podcasts, and also check out our Radio Catskill Community Awards. Coming up September 28th, we are honoring outstanding contributions to local arts and culture. Have a great weekend. I'm Tim Bruno. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. We went a little long today, so our segment with Hudson Valley Labor Association will wait for a minute, but have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
Support comes from Kip Inns Art Gallery in Walton, New York, upstairs at 150 Delaware Street. Open Saturdays and Sundays, 12 to 6 p.m., and first Fridays of the month, 4 to 8 p.m. No thanks. New paintings by Reese Ziemba opens this Saturday, September 9th, from 4 to 8 p.m. More information at kipnz.com. And from the River Reporter newspaper, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Time for pencils, time for books, time for teachers' dirty looks. The kids are back in the classroom, at least for now. This week on Notes from America, we speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who has tracked a six-decade-long movement to tear down public education. Has it worked? And what are the consequences for you and your family? Sunday evening at 6, live on Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. This week on The Splendid Table, we talk to the farmer Leah Penniman about how she combines farming with anti-racist activism. And then we talk with chef and farmer Abra Behrens about what life is like on a small farm right now, and we take your cooking and gardening questions. It's all coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
On Point is next, Democracy Now! At noon, and it's Science Friday at 2. The forecast for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania, cooler than yesterday. Mixed clouds and sun this morning, giving way to scattered thunderstorms this afternoon. There's a potential for severe thunderstorms, highs near 80. Scattered thunderstorms and potentially severe thunderstorms continue into the evening, low of 63, and then the thunderstorms still likely tomorrow and into Sunday as well. Tomorrow's high 75, high Sunday 71. It's 74. Air quality is good. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from 52 and Vine, a wine and spirit shop in Jeffersonville featuring local, national, and eclectic vintners and distillers. 52andvine.com. From the Upper Delaware Welcome Center at the Narrowsburg Union, featuring information about regional attractions and activities, along with products by the region's artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen at Catskills Curated. NarrowsburgUnion.com.
Bradley Cooper, welcome to Fresh Air.
Tina Fey, welcome back.
Bryan Cranston, welcome.
Sarah Silverman,
Karl Rove,
Hillary Clinton,
Stephen Sondheim,
Robert Redford,
Lena Dunham, welcome to Fresh Air.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Listen to Fresh Air Monday through Thursday at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like the Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
Treatment takes time.
It also gives time back.
My addiction does not define who I am, just as my medication does not define my recovery.
All you have to do
to change your life is change your mind.
It is up to you to figure out what is best for you.
Your goals.
Your life.
Your treatment plan.
Staying on medication for opioid use disorder is your path to recovery. Learn more at HealTogetherStories.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Radio Catskill.
On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
Public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.